Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, you're listening to your girl, Faiza, all the way from KK Kakuma Refugee Camp. So I would like to tell you a little bit about myself. I am Somali-born Australian. I live in Brisbane. I like weird TV shows. Guys, I watch Days of Our Lives. I am that weird. And guess what? I love fashion. I like enjoying life. I am me, and that's who I should be. Life is so Gucci.
This is In My Country, stories of people who came to Australia as refugees or asylum seekers and the many places we call home.
Hosted by Adam Wood and me, Pia Perversi-Birchall. This podcast was produced on Turrbal and Yuggera country. We pay our respects to traditional owners, past, present and emerging.
Faiza, wait, tell me what's Gucci about your life. I feel like that is a question. Tell me something.
It's all right. Oh, good. It's Gucci. You know, you don't, even if it's not Gucci, you have to be positive.
Today, we are talking with Faiza Adan. Faiza is a person who wears many hats, community worker, fashion designer, woman of big ideas. The first half of her childhood was lived out to the backdrop of the Somali Civil War. The second half was spent in Kakuma, one of the world's largest refugee camps. Pia talks to her about some of the experiences of family life in these settings, childhood stories that feel distant, but also strangely familiar, and about how she's been able to bring pieces of her past into her future in Australia.
To start off, I've heard a lot of people say that it's difficult to be yourself in your second or third or fourth language. Do you feel like you're able to be yourself in English?
Most of the time, the question that a lot of people ask me, would you marry someone outside your race? And I would always say no, because then I can't be myself, because I will be speaking English all the time. Mm. So I'm not going to have a time where when I'm angry or when I want to explain something. If I speak English the whole day, sometimes the words come out. I'm like, when I'm angry, I want to be able to actually scream.
Yeah, Somali.
You don't want to be thinking of words. You just, exactly.
Because even the words, like there's a lot of words in Somali that doesn't even make sense at all, but you can say it and it will hurt the other person. In my country, Somalia, where I was born, I don't have a lot of memories, but I left there because of the civil war. In the country that I grew up, which is Kenya, it was great because we had a lot of friends, a lot of family members around, even though I grew up in a refugee camp.
Okay, so you were born basically into the middle of a civil war in Somalia, and you were born around the time that the civil war was kicking off.
Faiza was born in the late 80s. The war started in 1991.
Can you tell me a little bit about what was happening at that time?
It was all around, you know, people were fighting because of tribes. And even today, like, I don't understand why, like, you know, the Somali is one religion, you know, one culture, but then there's all this civil war going on, like, because of the tribe and, you know, she's who and he's this and all that stuff.
I've tried to look into it a little bit myself, and it seems like it's so complex now and no one really knows what to do or how to address it because it's so deep and it goes back so far.
Even now, the war in Somalia continues. There are some reports that over 500,000 people have been killed since the war began. Faiza was born in the city of Baidoa in the southwest of Somalia. It was to this backdrop that she lived the first years of her life.
I remember all the gunfires and all that stuff. I remember moving from one city to another city because of the war. We kept moving between Baidoa and Mogadishu. There wasn't much of transportation. We just have to like walk from one suburb to another suburb because we lived in a suburb where that was the actual war zone, like where there's, you know, the people fighting. And then we walked to another suburb for a while. But the war never stopped. It kept going. All this time we're moving around and, you know, moving from one suburb to another suburb.
How would you know when it was time to move?
I guess my parents would know because when the gunfire starts, we just have to, like, you know,
get out of the way.
Yeah. And then after, like, 1995 is when we kind of settled. We were settled in one place, but then it wasn't still the same. The war wasn't very intense, but then there's still days and some nights are just like the gunshot starts and then we have to hide and, you know, mainly we used to hide under the house.
Faiza said that despite the war around her, she didn't really feel afraid. It was all she'd known.
No, I don't. Sometimes I remember days where when we hear the gunshots, so we just used to run outside just to see what's happening. Like,
because you're curious.
Yeah. You only know you're in a bad situation when you move from that situation and, you know, find a peace. And that's when you go back and reflect and be like, oh, I can't believe I've lived in this kind of life. Because at that moment, all you could actually think about is how am I going to survive? What am I going to eat tomorrow? Like, you don't think about, oh, I am actually scared. I'm not safe. Nobody actually thinks about that. It's just like, let's move on with our lives. You know what I mean? So for me, as a kid, I was like enjoying life, going to school and just happy.
Being a kid.
Yeah, being a kid.
What are some good memories of being a kid in Baidoa or Mogadishu?
In Somalia, you go out in the morning and then you can come back late at night and you don't have to have adult supervision. It's just, there's a freedom. As a kid, you're just free. You just go out, play with your friends. And then you come home, eat, and then sleep, and then you do the same thing next day. Today's world, you know, kids have phones, iPad, all these video games, because we had to make our own things. We have to entertain ourselves playing games and all that stuff. So it was fun.
In the early 90s, the government of Somalia completely collapsed and became known as a failed state. A failed state is a country whose government can't or won't deliver essential public services to its citizens.
Being a kid, it felt like now when I started watching the show, Walking Dead, if I thought about it, I was like, this is where I live. It's a country where there's no law, there's no rules, there's no system. Everybody sort of wakes up in the morning, looks for food, and it's just, it was a dead zone. People are dying for no reason. It's just like you live for the sake of
survival.
Yeah.
With the collapse of the government, food production and distribution was massively disrupted across the country. Famine quickly spread across southern Somalia, and within a year, 300,000 people had died of starvation.
Is that the sort of images
I've never seen anything like, because, you know, there's things happening, but then you don't see things like that. I've never seen someone dying. Like, I heard people dying, there's starvation, all that stuff, but I've never seen it.
In 1999, and there was no end in sight to the instability in Somalia, her parents made the decision to move the family to Kakuma refugee camp in northwestern Kenya.
I guess my parents are looking for a better life for us. So we traveled for 30 days and it wasn't fun.
They left Mogadishu smuggled in food trucks headed for Kenya. The family was split up across 5 or 6 trucks.
Me, my mom and my 2 little brothers are in one, because I'm like, if I'm dying, I'm going to have to die with my mom. We had to hide at the back because we don't have, you know, IDs or passport or anything. And that's how we crossed the border to Kenya.
Eventually, they arrived at Kakuma refugee camp. The camp covers an area of 15 square kilometres, and in February 2019, it had a population of approximately 149,000. That's similar to the population of Darwin.
It's big. It's like a city, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge. It was very windy and very hot and dry as well. People actually look really you know, your skin actually gets dry. You sort of look dead, like, you know, leaving a camp. So we arrived and then we got picked up and then we went to the house made of pretty much rubbish, like a lot of things put together. And we were like, okay, this is where we're going to be staying. And then for weeks and weeks, everyone's just crying, asking questions. You know, we kept asking, why are we here?
So had you come from a nice house, a nice home in Somalia?
And yeah, in Somalia we had actual bathroom, we had actual toilet. You know, it's not like here, but then it was actually way better than Kakuma.
And that sense of safety that Faiza had carried since her childhood in Somalia disappeared.
That's actually when I realised I wasn't safe, because in Somalia you have all your family around, like, you know, everyone, your grandma, everybody, all your family is just around you. Regardless of, you know, the war and everything, people were just happy. Like, they knew they weren't very safe, but here it's just different country. It's a foreign country. You don't know anybody. You have to start from scratch. There wasn't any gunshots or any wars, but then there's other people that will come at night. They rape, kill, do a lot of things.
Some things they'd been pre-warned about.
We heard all these stories, like this lady was telling my mom, there's this snake and it normally goes in the toilet. I don't know. So we arrived in Kakuma. There's no electricity. There's no water. There's the toilet. There's no roof. And then there's no door. That they put blanket at the door so people don't see you. And then I was in the kitchen and then I heard something going, and I'm thinking, that's it. That's the snake. Like, I'm dead. I'm literally dead. And then every time someone goes to the toilet, I keep hearing that sound. I'm like, that's it. The snake's actually in there. And then I was like, you know what? I'm never going to go in that toilet. I will literally, like, you know, never going to go in that toilet. And then the whole night, I didn't use the toilet until next day. So for like almost 12 hours, I didn't use the toilet. I was dead, scared. I was like, you know what? That's it. So mom, she used to stay up at the beginning when we arrived in Kakuma.
Mm.
She stayed up all night with her torch looking for scorpions, snakes and all this stuff. One night she felt something cold and then she looked at it and there's a red snake, a huge one. And she started screaming. It went actually inside the mosquito net. And then my little brother was there. He was 2 and he's lying and then the snake went over him.
It went over him.
Yeah. Mom was like, please, please don't move. And then luckily my brother didn't move. So the snake had to slowly.
I have stories like that from when I was a kid, but they were pythons that are not poisonous.
Well, I have a funny story. So you wouldn't believe it. This is one of the unbelievable stories.
Tell
my
me.
Mom always used to tell us her great-great-granddad was twins with snake. So every time something happens to her family, snake used to come around.
To watch out for the family?
Yeah. And then as a kid, I remember in Somalia, they used to feed the snake. They used to give the snake milk and all. I'm like, okay, this, like every time I tell this to my friends, they don't believe me, but that's what mom actually always tells us.
So was there significance for her of the snakes in the camp?
She's like, oh, I was ignoring my son and then the snake came. But yeah. I think maybe there's other reasons why the snake was there.
They lived at Kakuma refugee camp for 8 years, from 1999 to 2007. Faiza's dad fell sick and died a year and a half after they arrived at the camp.
He died in 2001, March 2001. So after that, then it was only mom.
Being a single mom in those environments, I imagine, is pretty tough.
Yeah.
Faiza's family had some financial support from relatives living in Australia.
But that wasn't enough. Every fortnight they used to give us food. UN will give you food. They used to give you maize, like a yellow maize. I don't know if you've ever seen. Like food that is not actually eatable, pretty much. It's food that are actually meant to be given to animals. And then mom, what she used to do is like sell that food so she can buy like groceries, rice or anything like that. So that's how we actually lived. That's how we survived. And not only my family, like there's all these other people, like about more than 30 or 40 people used to eat from my house. So mom will cook all this food. The door is always open. People come and eat whatever they see. There wasn't any restriction or you're not from this family, you can't eat. So she would provide for everybody.
Faiza's mom was also a pharmacist, trained in Somalia before the war.
Yeah, mom used to buy all this different medication like painkillers, anesthetics, all that stuff.
Amidst the malnutrition and disease outbreaks like cholera and malaria, Faiza's mum was a trusted source of information, better food, and access to medicine.
Did you have access to anti-malarial medication?
We did at home.
You did?
Pretty much everything.
Wow.
We had everything at home.
There were schools in the camp, but opportunities were quite limited. A 2017 report by the UNHCR stated that only 6% of the high school-aged children were enrolled, and only 1 in 5 of them were girls. Over half of the teachers were untrained. Faiza was one of the luckier ones. She completed school to grade 8, and she also learnt a decent level of English, which has helped her in the long run. At 14, she decided to leave school to find a job so that she could support her family. But first, she needed some skills.
My interest was actually everywhere.
There were opportunities for further study in Kakuma through charitable schools like Don Bosco. She started with fashion.
I was interested in fashion. I got into the dressmaking because a friend of mine was like, oh, hey, there's this course. You want to do dressmaking? I was like, yeah, sure. I want to make my own dress. So that's how I started. It doesn't have an age limit. As long as you can just speak English and write English, they'll give you the course.
Then she was given a scholarship to study IT.
As a kid, I was actually good at, you know, phones and stuff, even though I didn't have access, but I was good at
computers.
Yeah. There wasn't internet. They just teach you how to, it's pretty much software. There's no hardware and stuff. And then I realized that I was interested in helping people. So I moved to volunteering, doing a lot of volunteer works and stuff. Organized activity for the kids, like soccer game and all things like that.
But ultimately, all that time in the camp, they were waiting.
There's only one reason why we actually went to the camp, to actually get visa and just get out there.
Yeah.
We weren't planning to live there for the rest of our lives. So it was just, it was a bridge for us to go to better countries and stuff, you know, Australia, America, wherever we could actually go.
To be settled in another country, Faiza's family had to be deemed genuine refugees by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR.
It wasn't an easy process.
They were interviewed. They had to tell their family's story and put forward their case for protection in another country. After that, there was years of waiting for a decision. 6.5, to be exact.
There's a time where I felt like I wasn't going anywhere. We sort of like gave up, you know? We're like, people that are still in the camp, like that, they were born in the camp and they're there for like 20 plus years. Everyone around us were leaving, like, nah, we're not going anywhere. That's it. We traveled 30 days. We thought we were going to be safe, but we're not safe. We had to sleep with a fear every night. Fear of, imagine if someone breaks in. Imagine if someone gets raped. Imagine if someone gets killed, all this stuff. There's all these challenges. Like, we're not going anywhere. We're stuck here. There's no direction. There's no indication of if we're leaving or not. And they're like, okay, this is our life. We just have to leave. But then we just have to have a faith. We're like, okay, maybe one day we're going to leave.
Then they almost missed their chance. So the way that you'd find out that your case was being progressed was to check a notice board.
Our name was actually on the board and we missed it out.
Keeping an eye on that every day for 6.5 years isn't necessarily realistic.
Someone said to us, your name was actually there. And Mom was like, nah, that's not me. How come I don't know this? And then we're like, Mom, maybe it's us. Let's go. And then we didn't go. So they had to call out our names. And then someone was there like, your name was actually, they were calling your name. And then we went the second day and luck, thank God, we actually got it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
That was late 2006, and then we got lucky. Some people wait for years to actually have their flight. But then a couple of months later, they said, we get accepted, we pass everything and we go into Australia.
Next, they had to have medical checks and an interview with the Australian embassy.
You said that your mum was worried that you wouldn't pass the test.
Yeah, because if they see your temperature high, they're like, oh, you're sick, you can't go. And then that will actually
delay.
We've been waiting for 8 years. We don't want to like wait for, So she'll give us 2 Panadol every morning before we go to medical checkup. And then the doctors were like, how come your temperature is always the same? So mom would give us 2 Panadol. She's a gangster.
Finally, their visas were granted in January 2007. Faiza said from memory they had around 30 days to leave.
By the time we knew that we had to go, we gave away everything because people like, the minute that they realise that you're leaving, that people start asking for stuff. And then it's not the stuff that you can actually take with you. So we had to get rid of everything and we end up with nothing. So the whole time we were waiting for our tickets, we were just sleeping on the floor.
What did you take? Clothing?
Only clothing, yeah.
When the day came where you were actually getting on the flight, even on that day, you still weren't confident that you were going to get to Australia.
Yeah, because a lot of things happened around us. Like, this lady that are actually our neighbours went in the plane, and before the plane took off, she was called out to come down and they said, oh, you can't travel anymore. So we're like, oh, imagine if something happens and we sit there and we're like, oh my God, bye Kenya. But then they could actually come in and say, look, you're not going. Wow. So it was scary.
Do you remember being on the plane as it took off?
I sat on the plane and then I looked at the windows like, I will never come back to this country. As the plane was taking off, like, I was like, yep. Yeah. In the country that I live in my country, Australia, I actually love it because of the freedom, freedom of everything, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. And this is where I call home now.
Faiza's family of 12 left Kenya when she was 18. They flew into Brisbane.
We stayed in a motel in Sunnybank Hills and then we moved to Indrabilly and then we were there for one night. And then we moved to Holland Park. There was no water. The stuff wasn't working. Nothing was working. It was rubbish. Like, it was a shithole. And then I remember saying to the guy, what are we doing here? Hello, we're from a camp, but we know how these things. But then they didn't actually care. They're like, oh, this way you're going to have to leave, sign. And then we're like, we're not going to sign because the water's not working. The stove's not working. They said it was 5-bedroom house, but it was only 4-bedroom house. And they put them big bed in the living area, like,
and called it a
what
bedroom.
Do you think? What do you, like, you know, seriously, what do you think we are?
Because wait, how many of you were there?
12. And so they put my mom's bed in the middle of the living room and they put 2 beds in each room. And they're like, this is 5-bedroom house. So we stayed there one night and then we moved to Holland Park.
And you ended up split across 2 houses, didn't
you? Yeah. We had to because there's no other option.
You couldn't find a big enough house?
No.
Yeah.
We found 4-bedroom and 3-bedroom houses. So the boys lived in one house and the rest of us lived in another house.
What was that first few days or few months or that initial settling in period like?
I hated it. Like, it's just, I thought, oh my God, we waited all these years in a camp and this is Australia. There's nothing to do. You're just sitting around. We missed our friends. You sort of have to get used to it. Like, this is the life I've been given. What am I going to do with it? Like, you know, I have this. Where am I going to start? We don't know what's going on. I thought, oh my God, I don't even know where to turn. How am I going to do everything? Like, at the beginning, everything was just, I want to, like, learn how to drive. I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to do that. But then I thought I couldn't be able to actually do it. This is the 3rd time or 5th or 6th, I don't know, that we moved. So every time we moved from one place to another, we sort of press the restart button and then you sort of move on. So it was just like you have to find a way to actually make it work, build a new life. And the big thing that I was like, oh my God, we traveled for so long. Now that's it. We're never going to travel again. And that was sort of like, I felt like, that's it. I'm stuck here. Then I was like, oh, it's actually a good thing that this is why I was struggling all this time. We lived in a camp to actually come to this country. So this is where we have to start again. To be honest, I just wanted to sleep. I was like, I'm gonna do nothing. You know, I think it was just, it was going through some, so I was like, okay, maybe I'm just gonna relax and do nothing and, you know, enjoy life.
How long was that?
It didn't last long because I knew what I wanted. I was like, I wanted a life, but I'm not gonna get that without, you know,
putting in some work.
Yeah. But then as I started school and all the stuff, slowly everything sort of eased up. It felt like, yep, everything's settling, and then you feel like you belong. Yeah.
Did you feel safe?
I felt safe because the thing is, like, I don't even know what safety meant. But for me, I thought nothing could actually touch me. I even remember my cousin driving reckless, but then I thought nothing could actually kill me. I was like this free bird. I felt I've been lifted, like, this heavy thing that actually on my body was have been lifted. I felt free. I felt like, that's it. You're safe now.
Once she was ready to focus on her future, Faiza threw herself into her studies. She began with refining her English. And then remember the IT, community work and fashion from Kakuma?
I enrolled into Diploma of IT Networking. I didn't like it because I was the only female. A couple of months later, I'm like, nah, I'm not going to waste my time here. So I did my Diploma of Community Service.
Using that, she worked in disability services and childcare. And she even spent some time as a housing worker for newly arrived refugees.
How did you find housing the big Somali families?
It was fun. It was very interesting because I kept reflecting on what it was when I arrived and what it is now. Like, housing was horrible back then. But now you have all these options, like, oh, you don't, if you don't like the first house, there's always the second house. You know, sometimes I used to tell the client, you're actually very lucky. You should be thankful. You know, you have all these options. You have people always there for you. You have someone who speaks your language. So it was reflection for me.
Then in 2017, her position was made redundant. So Faiza decided to give fashion another go.
And I was like, oh, I did this when I was 14. There's a reason why I did this. And then I always wanted to have my own business. There's a million things that I want to do. So I was thinking about it. And then the redundancy came through when I was like, you know what? Maybe it's the time you actually start something. That's why I started my fashion business.
The small label is called Jabi Scarves.
It's Islamic wear.
Islamic wear.
Yeah. Anybody can actually wear who wants to be modest. Who wants to dress modest because it's difficult to find modest wear in the mainstream. So I sort of wanted to start my own thing because if I go to the shops, I have to buy three things to actually cover up.
Like to layer.
Yeah.
So if you want to dress modestly and you live in Brisbane, is it a lot of online shopping?
Yeah, mainly online shopping. Otherwise, if I go to other shops like H&M, I have to buy a cardigan and then I have to buy a dress and then I have to buy a t-shirt underneath to cover up. Yeah.
Jabi Scarves has been on hiatus for a year or so, but Faiza plans to come back to it in 2021.
And what's your vision?
I want to introduce the Islamic wear to the mainstream fashion.
Yeah. I've tried it out and I don't think I can pull it off.
Why not?
I think part of it is the colour. I think bright colours look amazing on dark skin. And I always am always inspired to wear really bright colours when I see that. And then I try it on and I just don't think it works. But
it's,
also,
it's just what you think. Because for me, I wear a lot of dark colours. And then people are like, why do you wear dark? Why do you wear dark? I'm like, why do I care what people think? It's me. Like, I like wearing that. Like, you know, some people actually feel like I'm being disrespectful towards other cultures. Like, you know, I've seen friends saying, can I wear the hijab? And then I'm like, yeah, that's okay. But then they feel like maybe it's disrespectful towards the religion. It's not. If you feel that you can pull it, then go ahead and, yeah. There's a lot of people that are actually not Muslim that wear turban.
Yeah, right. I have a lot of white Australian friends who would say that's cultural appropriation. You can't do that.
I don't. You think about if I take my hijab off, am I actually offending anybody? No, because that's how I want it to look, right? Like if you wear scarf, if you wear turban and you're having a bad hair day, I'm not going to say, oh my God, why the hell is she wearing turban? Like, you know,
yeah.
It's a piece of material that there's other reasons that you could actually wear
There's different reasons why people might choose to wear something.
Yeah, exactly. There's people that actually went through chemo that wear. Now I see people like, oh, why are you wearing this? Oh, you're bloody Muslim. I'm like, there's a lot of other reasons that you could actually wear. I used to have the longest. My eyebrows were so bushy. Like my hair was everywhere. Once I actually shaved the whole thing, gone. Lucky I wear scarf, so because I started my scarf from here.
You what?
I shaved all my eyebrows and then I started my scarf from here.
Oh. For like months. You put your scarf down below where your eyebrows were so no one could tell.
That was actually for 2 months. That's what I was doing.
Why did you shave them?
Well, I didn't know I shaved them. I was like, I took a scissors and then I was like, I have a lot of hair. I'm just going to trim a little bit. And then I was walking outside and then everyone's just looking. I'm like, what the hell are they looking at me? And then my friend's like, look at your face. I'm like, what? Look at your face. I went to the bathroom. I saw my eyebrows gone. And I was like, my mom's going to kill me. And then I started wearing my scarf from here for 2 months. Yeah, imagine. No scarf, no eyebrows.
Why do you wear the hijab?
It's part of my religion. And it's my choice. No one's actually forcing me to actually wear it.
Mm.
You can wear the hijab and be like, you know, fashionable. It's crazy. I've got a weird hair. Like it gets really straight from here until like here.
Like a perm that's growing out.
I did purple at the back. Like I did blue, pink. I did grey, purple, pink and blue at the same time. Okay, I wanted to do yellow and green, but then I was like, nah, that's too much. You know, you don't have to just wear it and look miserable. My ideal country would be Australia as well. I like Australia because of the opportunity that it provided, the freedom it gave me, the safe that I feel in this country. I can move forward, be happy, and this is where I want to spend for the rest of my life.
I also wanted to ask you about the refugee label and if you have any strong feelings or thoughts about it.
People are actually quick to judge or quick to say things about someone else that they have no idea what they went through. Being a refugee is not actually a choice that you made. It's a choice that someone else has actually made for you. Someone forced you to leave your country. You're not responsible of being a refugee and you don't know if it's going to happen to you as well. Like, you don't know, like anything could happen and then you would actually maybe leave your country and be a refugee in another country. So I guess seeking for safety, it's not something that you chose to actually do. It's something that you've been forced. And then it's human instincts that the first thing that you do is look for a better life for your kids, for your family. And that's how actually people become refugee.
Do you feel judgment from people about that?
Not personally, I've seen people that are actually being racist towards me, like, you know, saying go back to where you came from. I mean, sometimes, look, people are actually ignorant. They don't know what it's like to actually struggle because they have never seen a struggle. If everybody actually would go through, would have been in the same situation, people would actually be nice towards other. So I guess because you grew up in a country, you're born in a hospital, like you get all these resources, you know, you have a better house, your family has a car, you have a child seat, you know, you have iPad growing up, iPhone, all this stuff, TV. You've never seen a struggle and you live in this life, but then it's not a life that you chose. It's just, it was meant to be. So if someone else is struggling and they didn't have the same life that you had, you should be sensitive towards them.
So, what's next for Faiza?
I want to help girls in the camp, especially the camp that I grew up, Kakuma. Growing up, being a young woman, there's a lot of things that I actually need, especially toiletries, things that, you know, they can't actually have access to. And something that I wanted to do is do a charity, have a charity for them that people donate all this stuff. And then if I can find a connection, send them so they can have access to those things. I remember growing up, I never had access to anything like that, you know? And it's very difficult. There's other options, clothes people wear clothes, but then it's not hygienic. You don't have like something as simple as a soap. Sometimes you used to provide pads and stuff, but that wasn't even enough. If they have a resources, they get it every month.
But it's inconsistent.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that holds girls back?
Yeah. Because you don't feel comfortable going anywhere.
Who are your role models or who are people that you look to who inspire you?
myself.
Yeah, that's a great answer.
My biggest role model, my mom.
Mm-hmm.
She is my role model and she's my hero as well. I wish I could be the quarter of the woman she is.
What is it about her?
She's very strong. She survived all these years without her partner beside her. Like, my father passed away. Imagine raising two kids, actually hard. But raising all those kids, like, you know, She's very positive. Even today, she wants to help everyone in the community. She does everything that she could possibly do. And she stays positive regardless whether she's healthy or sick.
What about, let's go back to what you said before when you said yourself. Tell me about that. I love that answer.
Because I like doing things my way. I want to be my own role model. You know, I want to be unique. I want to do something differently.
We think these are important conversations to be having, and we'd love you to join in. Find us on Facebook or Instagram at In My Country Podcast.
If you like what you've heard, please tell your friends and rate us on your podcasting app or wherever you're listening. It helps us to be heard by more people.
This podcast was produced and edited by Adam Wood and Pia Perversi-Birchall.
Sound is mixed by David Gaylard. All of our music is from Free Music Archive. You can find full credits in the show notes or at inmycountrypodcast.com. Thanks for listening.